today's show is proudly sponsored by Minding the Gap. You guys all know that mental health for dancers matters. You're on board. You want to see the culture in your studio change, but where do you start? Enter Minding the Gap. Minding the Gap is dedicated to seeing mental health regarded with the same seriousness as physical health in dance culture, and they come armed with solutions. Whether it's helping you craft policies and procedures that protect the mental wellness of dancers and staff, consulting to build a robust mental health program in your school or company, or providing mental health skills workshops for your students and teachers, Minding the Gap has you covered. They bring the expertise of the best dance mental health experts in the world to you. For more information, visit www.wearemindingthegap.org or click the link in the show notes. Hello, dancers. Today, I spoke with Josh Spell, licensed social worker. He danced with Pacific Northwest Ballet and Kansas City Ballet. He currently works with dancers around the country, centering on dance from a holistic perspective and offering a variety of mental health tools. Today, I finally talk about it. The topic, eating disorders. I mentioned in the interview that I kind of feel like I've been putting it off, honestly. I'm not sure why, but I know that whenever I'm putting something off and I check in with myself, it's usually because of some deeper reason. In this case, it's my own struggle with disordered eating. But I finally felt ready to broach the subject, and Josh did not disappoint. He specializes in the treatment and prevention of eating disorders and has created a specially designed protocol he's currently implementing with the Pacific Northwest Ballet School. Not only do we talk about the treatment and prevention of eating disorders, but we also talk about what you as a teacher, parent, or artistic director can look for in the classroom and at home. Early intervention is so important in the treatment and prevention of eating disorders, and he really gives a ton of great information. Please remember that I am not a mental health professional, and anything you hear me say on the show is based on my personal experience and perspectives and should not be considered medical advice. By listening to this podcast, you agree not to use any of the content to diagnose you or anyone else of any mental health or other health condition. If any of the things in the show resonate with you, I encourage you to talk to your doctor or click the link in the show notes to find the best healthcare professional for you. And before we get started, I also want to mention that anything said on the podcast reflects my dance experience as a whole and not any one teacher, studio, or company. The opinions shared by my guests in this episode are their own and come from their individual viewpoint. Like I said before, this is such an informative conversation full of great advice for teachers, directors, and parents, and I cannot wait for you to listen. So, here you go. Hello, hello, dancers. Welcome back. I'm so excited today to introduce to you Josh Spell. You may have seen me post some things about him on my stories lately in Instagram. He's got a partnership going with our sponsor, Minding the Gap, and I'm so excited to have him here. Welcome, Josh.
Thank you so much. I'm excited to be here, Sarah, and just so curious about this conversation that we are going to have today.
Yeah, curiosity is definitely the name of the game, isn't it?
That's right. That's the only way we can sort of take new things in is we've got to have an inkling of, yeah, are there other options out there to explore?
Yeah, excellent. So excited. So listeners, today Josh is going to be talking to me about a topic that, warning up front, might be a little bit triggering for some of us, but I think it's definitely a conversation that has been missing from the show. I've covered eating disorders from a more scientific, sort of logistical side of, you know, what happens to our bodies chemically, hormonally, and that sort of thing if we are under or malnourished, but we've not actually pulled out the mental health piece, which is what I'm here to do. And honestly, I think it's been a little bit difficult for me to approach the subject personally. I do have a quite long history of disordered eating, And I feel like I'm in a good place right now. I'm actually 22 weeks pregnant, so I'm enjoying.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, thank you. So
congratulations.
So this is a totally new season for me. I've never had children before. It's a wonderful time. And I'm, for the first time, sort of enjoying, like, seeing my body expand, which is a whole other thing. So yeah, anyways, I'm just really excited to talk to you today about this topic and sort of delve into a few things. So before we get to all that, I'd love to hear for the listeners who, you know, may not be super familiar with your work yet, a brief overview of your relationship with ballet. If it's relevant and you feel comfortable, what role your mental health has played throughout your dancing career, and of course, how you came to be a licensed social worker helping dancers.
Yes. So I'm trying to just think of where to dive in there. I guess I'll start by sharing that I danced professionally with Pacific Northwest Ballet for 10 years. And then I also danced 2 years with Kansas City Ballet. So, you know, being a professional dancer obviously has a lot of felt experiences, and, you know, that directly impacted my decision to transition into the work that I'm doing now. But I think what was really sort of illuminating for me was when I took a year off. I thought I was actually retiring when I left PMB, and I guess the universe had different plans for me. But I ended up going back and did those final two seasons with Kansas City Ballet. And it was at that point that I really noticed how my mental health was directly impacted by the work that I was doing. And I think, you know, I was always someone that was curious. I mentioned that word before. And not afraid to sort of like dive in to therapy or to just openly talking about what I was going through in some context. I'll get to the other context in a moment.
Sure.
So, you know, I had an injury when I was 25 and tore my labrum. Mm. And it was really during that time that I guess started this exploration of self-awareness, of just wanting to know more about kind of the holistic person, what I refer to now as the holistic dancer. And, you know, starting that exploration really opened up a lot of avenues for me. But ironically, during that time, I also developed an eating disorder. So personally, I probably would, well, I know at that time I wouldn't have labeled it an eating disorder. Mm-hmm. You know, we could call it subclinical, but I really think it was a full-on, there was a lot going on. But I was in a place of denial, you know, associating my injury with not having control and needing to be more and more regimented, I think is really how it kind of just accelerated. And the rest of my career, I really kind of struggled with feeling like a prisoner to my body. Mm-hmm. And, you know, my self-worth as a dancer was really dependent upon my body. And I think I found a lot of confidence in just how I looked and how I showed up. Yeah. So that was all going on kind of more subconsciously. And I was addressing my mental health. You know, I would share that, yeah, there were body image concerns or there were things going on, but it was never like a deep dive into it. Mm. And so I do remember before I went back to dancing professionally, I did seek out an outpatient therapist who was specifically trained in eating disorders. Again, kind of just, you know, brushed the surface there. Obviously, there was some stigma that I had for myself, adding in being a male identified dancer, you know, and eating disorders that often does not get recognized in the same way that, you know, there is a specific population, and we can go into that later, but I guess I'll just say now it's more kind of associated with white women. which it's just not true. I mean, eating disorders sort of just surpass all kind of boxes in terms of race and gender and age and socioeconomic status, all of the above. So, you know, I think getting to have the space to form some sort of healing or begin the journey was helpful. And then I get back into the ballet studio. A lot of those same thoughts really came back in terms of perfectionism, not so much the like specific eating disorder, but there were times where my body naturally just kind of responded to the work. And then I would get caught up in, oh my goodness, now I need to keep it like this. And then that did definitely influence some of my eating patterns. But, you know, I think I had this really unique vantage point of having perspective, but then also going back into the studio and really feeling the effects of just the pressure. And a lot of those beliefs that I thought I had created space around kind of just came rearing back. And it was at that point that I was like, oh, mental health in dancers.
Yeah.
It's a real thing. And it also is a huge contributing factor to performance, to self-image, to interacting with others, to self-esteem, to self-compassion, all of those things. And early on when I was at Kansas City Ballet, I realized that I was ready to retire. And so I intentionally just kind of started this search of where would I land and what would be the best path in order to help dancers. And it's interesting saying this now because, you know, in 2014, that wasn't really an option to have a job helping dancers. So my main focus was really eating disorders because there was this connection that I had experienced as a dancer. And I thought, you know, this is really close to what I know. I can relate. Many of my colleagues have shared similar struggles. So I'm going to focus on eating disorders. And that's what I did. And got my undergrad, got my master's degree. And then I completed the licensure process, which is about 3 or 4 years. And that allows me now to practice individually, independent is what it means, licensed independent clinical social worker. And I can work one-on-one, I can diagnose individuals, I can do private therapy, I can just basically support dancers and be in the position that I am now.
Oh, that's lovely.
It's a lot. I'm like,
a lot. Yeah, it's a lot, but it's so important on so many different levels for dancers to hear your story, because I did a couple of Instagram posts the other day about this, and it's like, no matter where you're at in your career, what's going on, what you're experiencing, it's all valid, and it's so important if you're feeling comfortable to share it, because chances are there are a handful of dancers in your immediate circle who are going through similar issues. And the more we talk about it, the more we share, the more normalized our feelings become and the less stigma there is on seeking professional help. So, you know, I love hearing these stories. And also from another standpoint too, career 2.0. I mean, so many dancers are out there are like, okay, well, I'm dancing now, but like, what could I do next? You know? And so any kind of career that helps you to continue in your love of dance, if that's what you would like to do, it's really exciting to hear those stories. So thank you for that.
Of course.
Yeah. Okay. So here we go, guys.
Ready to take the deep dive?
I know. We're like all hanging on. Okay, so of course, like I mentioned before, I've spoken to nutritionists and researchers about physical effects of malnutrition, but let's talk about where it all starts. I'd love to get your perspective, first of all, what instructors and directors should be looking out for, and what to do and what not to do if they suspect a dancer is struggling with some disordered eating patterns. And I'd also like to kind of like wrangle in that piece about the different populations. And because I feel like, and correct me if I'm wrong, but access to help for eating disorders may be limited if you are not a white female, because that's the biggest population that you mentioned. So I'd love to kind of fold that in as well.
Sure. Yeah, I think what's helpful to sort of start this conversation is just to give a little bit of context, just in terms of like where we are. And the reality that, you know, dance is an aesthetic sport, and there is a lot of emphasis on the body. And, you know, it's essentially what we do as dancers is literally expose our bodies, right? Our body is our instrument. It is our way of making art. It is what audience members see when they are coming to the ballet. And so sometimes it's difficult to separate, right, sort of like the physical body with like the I am, who I really am. Mm. So, you know, I think psychoeducation just around kind of what we're facing in the dance world is so important, just to lay the context for directors, for artistic staff. You know, because it's hard to have a conversation without knowing all of the pieces. So, you know, with that being said, you know, we train for many hours, professional dancers, you know, thinking about even just recreational dancers, people who love dance and just want to do it for the love of it. Again, like taking a class, that's a long time to literally look at yourself in a mirror.
In tights, right, in
a very specific clothing that does call attention, like I said before, to the body. So, you know, with that being said, I think that often dancers or teachers, directors have been in a space where it is maybe obvious that someone is struggling. But what are those kind of signs? And what does that mean? How do you even approach that? So, you know, I think if we just kind of start by just, I don't know, having some concrete things to look for, body checking is really a big one. And, you know, oftentimes if we find dancers sort of lost in the mirror and kind of distracted, maybe, you know, you say their name or you're giving them a correction and they don't even realize it. Or as you're giving the correction, they are just stuck in the mirror. And again, I guess I also want to say, this is really important, that not all dancers will struggle with disordered eating, with body image concerns, with eating disorders. Mm-hmm. But what we do know is that there are body image challenges that can lead to disordered eating, which then is almost sort of, I guess it can lead to eating disorders. So I said that kind of clunky, but what we do know is that individuals who struggle with disordered eating have a higher likelihood of developing a clinical eating disorder. So I think, again, I want to not just make assumptions. And I also, for our listeners out there that maybe do look at themselves in the mirror and do have that relationship, I want to also normalize that that's actually happening. But what I'm referring to is really more of an obsessive relationship. Other things that we can look for are like maybe hiding your body, wearing really baggy clothing, and you know, needing to wear a lot of clothes because an individual is always cold, perhaps. if there is something more serious going on, like bulimia and purging, you know, we can see maybe some signs on the back of the hand or puffiness around the jaw area. An obvious one is really these significant changes in weight. But as I say obvious, most would say, oh, a drop in weight. But what we also have to consider is this could be an increase in weight. Mm. Not all individuals who restrict, their bodies do not respond by dropping weight.
Interesting.
So we have to be really careful about making that assumption that people in larger bodies, a dancer who maybe is considered, you know, at a higher weight, oh no, they don't have an eating disorder because they're not thin.
Yeah.
So really important disclaimer to put out there.
Interesting.
But yeah, any of these like significant changes, perhaps mm-hmm. there is a lot more muscle definition, and that could be a sign of carb depletion. So really kind of just changing the diet very specifically, and probably aligns with some of those conversations that you had more about that nutritional and kind of like the metabolic consequences of mm-hmm.
like female athlete triad, for example.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. So, but when we are decreasing or, you know, undernourishing, mm-hmm. there's the word.
There you go. Yeah. Yeah.
You know, also we may see like signs of sunken or dark circles under the eye. This can really be a sign of malnutrition. I guess I want to bring attention to something called orthorexia, which is kind of this focus on really clean eating. And so maybe specifically only eating one type of food group. And so a dancer is saying to a director, no, I am fueling. I'm eating carrots and salads and celery and right, just this very specific type of diet, you know, that also can be problematic because, you know, again, there's not enough caloric density. And so there can be things like orange palms, perhaps, or orange hands, you know, from eating a lot of carrots. That is a sign there. Kind of back to the difficulty concentrating. Mm-hmm. And not being able to make it through rehearsal or make it through class, especially kind of by the end of class, decreased speed or stamina. And then like isolation, right? Like maybe the individual's personality has shifted. Maybe they are not interacting with the rest of the group. Maybe when you have a conversation with them, they are a little more vacant, not able to really be present there. So just more withdrawn or maybe not behaving in a way that you have come to know the dancer. So injuries, that can be another one too, right? Stress fractures. If you see this sort of increase in, you know, injuries, kind of just getting curious about what is going on. So those are kind of just some of those obvious signs that I think teachers can be aware of.
Yeah. Yeah. This is all really good information. The orthorexia, I don't know if I'm saying that correctly.
You are.
Yeah. Is not something that I'm familiar with. And I'm really interested to hear how you differentiate or what to look out for if you know, for example, a dancer is a vegetarian or they've chosen a keto lifestyle or something like that. Like, where's that line between, like, this is a lifestyle choice they're making and, you know, where it bleeds into this issue?
Yes, I think you're bringing up a really good point, kind of like, where is the line?
Mm.
And that's why I just want to make sure that yes, our listeners that are vegetarians or are vegan, no, that does not mean automatically that there is something going on. because you can fuel yourself as you know, a vegan and a vegetarian. I always would encourage dancers to work with a dietitian if there are any sort of changes in, you know, taking out food groups, things like that, just because you will have to compensate, you know, with more protein in other areas. I don't want to get out of my sort of wheelhouse. Again, like as a therapist working with eating disorders, I often do work closely with dietitians. So I have an awareness of, you know, what that may look like. But again, there are a lot of factors that contribute to the diagnosis of an eating disorder. You know, it's not just about the actual like food or the diet that an individual is eating. There are also things, you know, like just psychological factors and sort of feeling a loss of control or kind of some interpersonal factors, you know, kind of struggling to share emotions and be kind of open in that way. Social factors, you know, just kind of the way that we view what a dancer looks like or the culture of ballet or even growing up. What are the cultural norms around aesthetic or other values? And then temperament. So kind of with the orthorexia, you know, we're not just looking at like, what's the food group that this individual is concentrating on. There often can be a disruption in their life. Mm. There can be a rigidity around, if I deviate in any way, I am in huge distress. Yeah. Anxiety spikes, depression spikes. So, you know, it is very nuanced.
Yes.
But the thing about these diagnoses is we refer to the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, the DSM, and orthorexia is actually new. It's a new diagnosis, but we have several like concrete contributing factors to that. So it's not just as simple as, oh right. yeah, you know, we're really focused, or maybe from a more like spiritual or, you know, just values lens kind of not eating meat or something
right.
like that.
Sure. Yeah. 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 That's important to keep in mind too. So fascinating. So when we're talking about these signs and like outward signs that we might notice, whether it's orange palms or personality changes or a combination of those things, I think it can be really difficult for, I mean, of course, we're talking about different cohorts, right? We're talking about minors, we're talking about you know, early on professionals, seasoned professionals, you know, you have all of these different stages of life. So of course, directors and teachers and so forth have to treat those situations appropriately, especially when you're talking about minors. But I think it's really, there's a lot of pressure on people in leadership, especially those who want to really care for their dancers, that they don't want to say the wrong thing, or they don't want to embarrass the student or call them out on something that may not actually be going on. Or, you know, how can we best help them without making the situation worse?
Yes. Yes. Such a good point. And, you know, I think what I would just kind of more globally shout out is do not address a dancer in front of the entire room. Do not comment on weight. Do not comment on body. And I really think that that's kind of just all around.
Yeah.
You know,
positive or negative.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Positive or negative. And I think that that really kind of goes into a different conversation just about how do we deliver corrections, you know, by saying like, suck in your stomach or lengthen your leg, you know, things like that, which we do need to get more specific now in 2022, just about like, what do we mean by corrections? But back to kind of our topic here, I would definitely kind of speak to the dancer in private. And, you know, I think that this is a lot of, this feels like a lot of pressure, and it can feel very heavy because you don't want to say the wrong thing. But I think what I always like to remind individuals is kindness is actually kind of having difficult conversations. Mm. And if we kind of just follow that fear of, I don't want to say the wrong thing, then a dancer may slide by without something being recognized. Yeah. And here's the thing about eating disorders. They thrive in secrecy. Mm. There is a lot of denial at the beginning. There is a lot of ambivalence. And so it does become tricky in terms of how do we sort of genuinely show someone that we care without maybe pushing them further away. Mm-hmm. So, you know, this is something that I'm still working on because I will be very open. Working in an eating disorders clinic is very different than working as the consulting therapist for a ballet school and ballet company.
Yeah.
Because the individuals who are in eating disorder treatment, even though, yes, there's ambivalence there, it's almost like they have made the decision to get care.
It's in the open.
It is.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. Mm-hmm. And so when we approach someone, a dancer who, you know, we don't want to make any assumptions. I don't want to assume that that person is, you know, restricting or, you know, whatever, purging or purging through exercise, whatever that is. I don't want to make those assumptions, but some things are obvious, right? Like we started the conversation. Dancers wear very body revealing clothing.
Yeah.
So when you see these drastic changes, it is almost our responsibility as those sort of in a leadership position to acknowledge it, because you may see it before the individual's family even sees it.
Yes. Well, because the family sees them every day. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, as a pre-professional teacher, you probably see them close to every day, but you know, those changes can be so gradual. Their mom or mm-hmm. dad, if it's a child, or their partner or a friend or whoever's in their support system may not notice it right away because it can be very mm-hmm. gradual.
Yeah. Well, right. And it's like, have you seen your kid in a bathing suit in right. January.
Yeah.
You know, it's
yeah.
like, oh, well, I saw them this summer. They looked great. Okay. Well, here's 6 months later. Mm-hmm. Probably not, but a teacher, a director, a rehearsal director has.
Yeah.
So what I share with, you know, some of the teachers that I work with is to follow that intuition. If you know something is wrong, and often, you know, individuals who are in these positions as directors, as teachers, they've probably been in the dance world, right? You know, mm-hmm. it's not like, oh, this is our first step in the dance world. No, they've grown up in it. And so we've all seen individuals who have really struggled. And there's often sort of a like nagging feeling that something is going on. Mm-hmm. So, you know, when we pull that dancer to the side, I think the first thing, again, is showing our authentic concern. We don't want to be accusatory. Mm-hmm. We don't want to make assumptions, like I said. We also want to take ownership of how we do express our concern. And so really being able to say, like, I am wondering, I am concerned that your health and well-being could be in danger. I want more for you than being controlled by how your body looks. Let's get some help.
Yeah.
You know, things like that. And sort of this genuine compassion, genuine curiosity for what the dancer may be experiencing. Mm-hmm. Because often, you know, like I have said, it's not just about like food or body. It can be about so many other things. And I think, you know, we've seen that really take place during the pandemic.
Oh, yeah.
Where, you know, I can't specifically say if eating disorders have increased. I can say that mental health disorders have increased. And an eating disorder is a mental health disorder.
Yes.
So, you know, but again, not focusing on weight and eating. And, you know, this is where it does get tricky, because I also feel like we need to be really direct mm-hmm. in terms of, like, I am noticing that this, like, you look completely different than you did at the beginning of the year. Mm-hmm. But that can be sort of a challenge, because kind of the way that we're coaching teachers is to really not comment on someone's body,
right?
Whether the weight is up or down, kind of like what you said earlier.
Or the muscle tone is more obvious, or
Yeah. So, I mean, I want to be transparent that this is an ongoing conversation. Mm-hmm. And the fact that we are actually having it in the dance world, right, in companies, having it here on this platform, we're not going to have all the answers kind of figured out, because then that makes me think of even like the conversation about, well, what is a dancer's body? Like, mm-hmm. what is a ballet body? Because that is a conversation that has shifted, right? In terms of race, in terms of just ability, I mean, so many contributing factors that we have to recognize that everyone has different genetics and you can't fit someone into just this like standard of this is what a ballerina looks like or a ballet dancer looks like.
Right.
So there's a lot more nuances that we have to consider, but I think, again, for teachers who are concerned, I keep bringing us back there, you don't have to have all of the answers. You don't have to know how to treat or fix this individual. What you can do is just share that, hey, I see you and I am worried, right? Like, this often maybe opens up this space of, oh, I'm not getting away with it anymore. Because again, for a while, as you know, with some of the reds or the cliff effect, that dancers are on a high. They are feeling really good. Maybe they're even dancing the best they've ever danced. And teachers and directors and those in the front of the room are noticing that. But at some point it goes and falls off.
Drops off. And I think even for some dancers, getting that feedback of like, I notice your weight is lower, or I notice that, you know, these things are happening. I think for some dancers that might be positive feedback.
You're right.
So like, oh, my efforts are being rewarded. People are noticing. So that can be really tricky too.
And, you know, as you're saying that, kind of this addition maybe of, I am concerned about the longevity of your career. I want you to be able to dance for as long as you can. And what we know about the body is dance is already hard enough. And so we want you to be fueled in a way that supports your strength and mental clarity as a dancer.
Sustainability.
That all of a sudden just sort of like, popped in. I'm like, okay, let's add that. If we can't necessarily say like, you look too thin, or are you eating? We can say like, I want you to dance. I want you to be here. You know, like I love you as a dancer, but again, like being a dancer is not just what a body looks like.
Oh, such good stuff here. Excellent. Real quick before we move on, talking about minors in dance. If you're working for a school or conservatory, do you recommend speaking to the parent first or calling a meeting with the parent and the child?
So I think, again, this is contextual, because sometimes the parents will reach out first. Maybe the school has contacted the parents to say there's something going on. What I always do is include the preteen in the conversation of like, I want this individual to take ownership of what's happening. So I don't think that there's really a right or wrong in terms of like, do we meet individually? Do we meet together? I guess I always lean more towards like directly meeting with the student mm-hmm. first, mm-hmm. Just so I can hear what's going on from their perspective.
Yeah.
But you know, it might be difficult to open up. There may not again be sort of an understanding of what's fully happening. Mm-hmm. And so having that collateral information can be really helpful.
Yeah. Yeah. That's really cool. Good stuff. All right, so I hear that you have developed your own sort of specialized eating disorder treatment protocol, and I would love to hear some details about that, how it's going. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm really excited to hear about it.
Yes, so it's been a long road, and I can't take full credit. I can take credit, but I want to first just acknowledge the Australian Ballet really kind of helped guide the process. And then my colleague, Monica Van Winkle, who is the consulting dietitian for Pacific Northwest Ballet School. She is a sports dietitian here in Seattle. So we really worked collaboratively to come up with just a guide. Mm-hmm. Because what we were finding is there was really not a clear way of going about this process. And without that in place, it can often feel very punitive. You know, you need to see the therapist, yeah. you need to see the dietitian. Mm-hmm. We actually need you to not come to class for a few days or things like that. And so what we really wanted to do was just normalize that, you know, this is part of being a dancer. Because it is so focused on the body, there may be times when teachers are concerned, again, with weight going up or down.
Yeah.
And so the protocol really kind of took away some of that like guessing mm-hmm. and some of that just like kind of direct punitive action. And so what it does is it's sort of a set of just guidelines and steps for if a teacher notices something is going on, a teacher can notice, a parent can notice, a peer can notice, whoever notices will then alert me, the consulting therapist, mm-hmm. and I'll do, you know, a brief assessment, kind of just get a better snapshot of what is going on. And, you know, again, it's not always an eating disorder.
Yeah.
Sometimes it can just be a lack of knowledge in how to fuel. Mm-hmm. And, you know, growing, a growth spurt,
yeah.
for example, or maybe it's another medical condition. You know, our protocol has really helped identify things that were not eating disorders.
Yeah, thyroid disorders, for example, are so common.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So yes, we'll do the assessment. And then, you know, if I see any yellow or red flags, which that's also included in our protocol, mm-hmm. there's kind of like a stoplight graphic that just shows like what goes on in the green and then maybe some things, you know, like dieting, for example, or just rigid thoughts about food, increased exercise, you know, those get into the yellow and red zones. So mm-hmm. if we see anything like that, then I will just alert Monica, the dietitian, and she'll do another assessment just because, again, she has a very different scope mm-hmm. of work mm-hmm. and can actually look at, okay, well, what is going on? So then from there, there's just more support around if there just needs to be some additions to food and more flexibility with food and more choice with food. But if there is something really going on, then we would bring on a medical doctor. Mm-hmm. And we have a very specific form that has different tests and markers that we want. Because also in my experience, I have found that sometimes doctors also overlook eating disorders.
Absolutely.
And, you know, I was at a training last year where there was a statistic of MDs get 14 to 16 minutes of training for eating disorders their entire career.
Yeah.
education.
So
career,
many things
whatever
they
that's
have
called.
Yeah, so many things they have to cover in med school, and I think their nutrition education is probably even less than that. In
Wow.
some cases, you
Yeah.
know. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. So we sometimes hear, oh, well, they are an athlete. So of course their blood pressure is going to be low.
Sure.
Or their heart rate is low. But, you know, some of these tests like orthostasis, that's sort of the stand or resting to standing position with heart rate, or bradycardia, you know, again, like just checking some of these metabolic panels can show us more just in terms of what may be going on.
Yeah.
So we'll kind of take that to the next level. And then we look at medical clearance, because again, what this is really about is showing all of the dancers around that we're not just going to like turn the other cheek if someone is struggling. That we are taking it serious. And if it is to the point of needing higher level of care, you know, a dancer will be asked to take a break because we have to look at this like an injury. I always say an eating disorder is a psychological injury. And just like if you sprain your ankle, you're not going to be pushing through class. You know, you probably will take maybe a couple of weeks off. You may not even be watching class. And so kind of looking at it the same way also is contributing to a culture shift. So that's really kind of the overview of why we wanted this protocol in place, because we don't want it to be a guessing game. And, you know, we are still learning. There's still things that we are, you know, now that we have it in place that we're like, oh, well, we didn't account for this. Or, you know, what happens if someone doesn't want to receive our care? How do we kind of go about that? And, you know, so they're looking at consequences, at setting boundaries. But again, this is a learning process. You know, it feels strange to say, but this hasn't really been done in companies across the United States. You know, that's why we are looking to Europe and Australia for some guidance here.
Australia, I know, has definitely got some really exciting things, and all different types of dance research is kind of all happening there right now. So that's really great that you have that partnership. You know, it's really interesting to hear this, because I feel like this is something that even, you know, we're talking about Pacific Northwest Ballet, one of the top schools in the country, but also, you know, applying this type of model on down, you know, to your neighborhood dance studios, your competition studios, your, you know, regional ballet studios and that sort of thing. You know, I think this type of model is really inspiring because it's doable. You know, it's something that perhaps this protocol could be transferred easily to, you know, other schools, and maybe in the future training other, you know, social workers and therapists and so forth to be able to implement this. Because like you said, a lot of times it gets missed, because, you know, I know personally, I would go get my physical and my doctor would weigh me, you know, take my height, all of this stuff. But it was always just sort of like, yeah, she's a ballet dancer. Like, what do you want? What do you want me to do? You know? Yeah. So it's really interesting.
Yeah. And, you know, kind of talking about paring it down. I think what listeners who maybe are in more regional environments, you know, is it's really just about having a team. It's really about having, you know, a therapist, a doctor, and a dietitian who have some understanding of eating disorders and kind of even having resources, even just posting like, these are some options, which, you know, that might take a little networking, but that also is part of community building. You know, it takes on a lot of just helpful, just aspects of just having a ballet studio.
One of my guests, I apologize to everybody because I cannot remember who it was that said this, but one of my guests compared a dancer to a race car. You have a team. You know, you've got your ortho, you have your GP, you have your dietitian, you have your psychologist or social worker, your therapist, whoever. You know, you've got your parents, your friends, your non-dance friends. Like, it's all, everybody is there, you know, to change the tires before they blow out, you know,
yes,
to maintain, to, you know, keep everything tuned up so that you can succeed. And I think, you know, this is just one other piece that, you know, you may not, like you said, you may have a subclinical eating disorder, or you may have something that's not quite full blown, but you might be having these obsessive thoughts, or, you know, you might be having the start of an eating disorder. And if it's normalized that, oh yeah, I've got somebody on the team I can go talk to that about before it becomes a real issue. You know, it's just so encouraging to have those people around you that all love and support you and just want you to be the best dancer that you can. So
yes. Yeah. Thank you for that reminder, because I think, again, the protocol is also meant to be preventative.
Yeah.
Right. Because what we do know is that dancers maybe who are under fueling, maybe that does sort of spark then that plants the seed for an eating disorder, if you will. So if we can kind of interrupt that early on, then maybe it doesn't have to get to the point of a full blown eating disorder.
Right. Yeah. Oof. So good. All right. So I know we're kind of getting close to the end here. But
already?
I know, right? I think we could probably chat about this all afternoon. So talking about two things here, leadership, you know, so we've focused a lot on leadership. I also want to kind of pull parents in because, you know, they're an important piece of a younger dancer's life. But what can we do to be proactive and just encourage a healthy relationship with food, healthy eating habits in and out of the studio? You know, like I said, both leadership and parents, you know, how can we work together to just sort of not put pressure on dancers with their eating habits, but just to sort of normalize a healthy and balance, a healthy environment for that sort of thing?
Sure. Yeah, you know, this makes me think kind of even more like zoomed out in terms of diet culture. Mm-hmm. And I think dancers who are in adolescence, you know, are just kind of like soaking up everything that they see around them.
Yeah.
And I think the first thing we have to know or understand as role models is that maybe they're going to pick up some of the things that we maybe modeling. So kind of saying things like, oh, this is a healthy food, this is not a healthy food. Oh, I look fat today. Oh, back when I was thin as a dancer, you know, how many of us, I mean, I have said
I've done it before. Too. Oh my gosh. Yeah. Yes. Yes.
You know, and so I think that's something that we really have to look at. Like, what are we showing them? Mm-hmm. Are we only picking certain food groups that we eat? And then we're like, oh yeah, but you all eat whatever you want. Mm-hmm. I mean, what's that mixed message going to, you know, provide?
Yeah.
So I think we really have to just look at some of the root of this, which is fat phobia.
Yeah.
And just the larger impact of what diet culture kind of impresses upon us, you know, just thinking about like every New Year's that comes around, it's like, oh yeah, what do we see on TV? You know, it's like weight loss or a diet program or working out more or whatever that is. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, thinking about what are the pictures that are up around the studio? What dancers are we broadcasting at home? Like, what are we saying about even the shows that we see on TV? Are we commenting on people's bodies? Are we, again, like, labeling things as like, this is a healthy way of living, this is an unhealthy way of living. All of that has to really be acknowledged in order for us to shift the way that we view bodies. Mm-hmm. Because then when you get into the dance studio, it's even more magnified.
Yeah.
Right. So I think that that's where it sort of starts unraveling, is recognizing, you know, do we have fat phobia? Mm-hmm. And it's so interesting, and I'll share this, and it's a really vulnerable thing to share, but it wasn't until I started working in eating disorders that I even knew that I had thin privilege. And that was sort of this like, pow, like my mind exploded. Wow. And that really helped me to sort of get to this root of some of the fat phobia that I had. And, you know, where did that come from? You know, ironically, my mom is a dietitian.
Really?
So I heard a lot of things growing up. Yeah. About like, yes, this is healthy, this is not healthy. Mm. You have to move this many minutes every day in order to have a healthy lifestyle. And so for me, I already had that temperament of, you know, kind of being on the extreme. And then I became a ballet dancer. Who would have thought? So I think we have to look at, there are a lot of pieces, you know, like we can't just sort of point at one specific you know, contributing factor.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I think that's really interesting. I mean, we hear a lot, we're hearing a lot more and more these days, you know, words matter. You hear that phrase all the time. And whether you're a parent who might be struggling with their own issues and you don't want that to bleed over to your child, you know, or someone in leadership at a dance school or what have you, I mean, just, it's almost like a tick, you know, sometimes for some of us, or almost like it's a habit of just looking in the mirror and just going, ugh, today this, or today that, or, you know, and you don't even have to verbalize it for them to pick up on it.
Right.
You know?
Right. It's so true. And if I can just share really, really briefly,
Of course.
You know, I want to normalize that you maybe are going to not be happy with your body. Mm-hmm. There are going to be days, right, where there are ups and downs.
Yeah.
Maybe there are extended weeks. but if we look a little bit at body image flexibility, we can make more room for the ups and downs of kind of what that means. And, you know, I talk a lot about this because I think it's just so helpful, but just thinking about it as an interpersonal relationship. And, you know, you fight with your partner, you fight with your peers, you fight with your roommate, you know, it's like, it's not always harmony. And if we can give our bodies, you know, kind of some of that same grace, and it gives us more flexibility, right?
Yeah.
You know, there is more tolerance that's there. You know, some people don't even, like when you say accept your body, it's just like, it blows up. So just understanding that, yes, just because we are dissatisfied, we don't have to broadcast it. You know, we can talk about it with a therapist or with, you know, someone who we can confide in, but we definitely don't want that to really leak out to our kids.
Right. Yeah. Because they're learning how they're supposed to have a relationship with their own body. By what they see, but what they hear, what they're being told, you know, that sort of thing. So, and as a expectant mother, on my mind a lot.
I'm imagining it is.
And I'm having a girl. So it's like,
oh my goodness.
So not that it couldn't affect a boy, but I, you know, assuming I'll have some kind of shared experience as a young child, you know? So. Yeah, it's very, very interesting. So before I let you go, I've got two closing questions. They're a little lighter, a little more fun. I ask all of my guests, and it's been really fun to get their answers. So the first one is, I'm going to give you my magic wand. And I know it's very exciting, and you can wave that wand. But of course, you can only change one aspect of the ballet world. What would it be?
This is a tough one.
I know.
Just because of lived experience and you know, many different roles. But I think the one thing that I would want to shift is a culture of openness. Because with that, and really kind of staying on theme with what we're talking about today, there can be more of this using our voice, learning how to use our voice to say, I'm injured, or I'm having body image concerns, or I'm struggling with depression, or I have anxiety, or I just want to talk as a human and express if something, I don't understand something, like a correction, mm-hmm. or if something did really hurt me, maybe I can say like that hurt. So being open, I think, could really unravel a lot of these traditions that we are afraid to sort of deviate from.
Yes, I love that. Yeah, yeah, that would trickle down to so many different aspects of things that so many people are struggling with. So yeah, I love that. Okay, so now I'm going to put you in a time machine. I'm going to send you back to 14-year-old Josh, who was likely in the throes of pre-professional training, on the cusp of it all, summer intensives and performances and being in a big school, all of that sort of thing. So you're going to have a one-on-one with your 14-year-old self. And what would you say?
Well, when I was 14, I was back in Beaumont, Texas. And I think maybe I went to a summer program at Joffrey San Antonio. So I would just remind my younger self to continue having the same joy that I was experiencing at that moment, and to just sort of keep sort of the larger picture of what I was doing with dance. It wasn't about the details. It's not about perfection. It's not about getting everything right. It's not about not making mistakes. It's about including the whole experience, because this will contribute to more longevity and more joy, and you will be experiencing it your entire career, instead of after the fact, once you retire, being like, oh, that was pretty amazing.
Yeah.
Wasn't it?
Wait, I love the expression, these are the good old days.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it's my favorite one.
I just posted something yesterday, in honor of PMB's Romeo et Juliet, Jean-Christophe Maillot, his work. There was a picture of me with him that was from the first time that we did it. And I put dancing days, because it was like the good old days.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. So being present and really being content and happy, you know, where you're at now, because no matter what stage of life you're in later on, you're going to look back and say, that was it.
Right. Why didn't I do that? Why didn't I just have fun?
Yeah. Yeah. I love that. Such a joyous aspect of your career. I love hearing those stories. So, well, thank you again so much for your time today. This has just been so informative. First of all, I've learned so many things, and also very hopeful and encouraging for all of our leadership members in dance companies and schools and our parents and our students and all of that stuff. So before I let you go, is there any, I'd love to tell my listeners how they can connect with you. If maybe we have other artistic directors who are interested in this type of program, they have questions for you, where can we find you?
So the easiest is to go to my website. It is flexiblemindcounseling.org. And there is a contact sheet that you can just fill out, and it'll go to my email, which is josh@flexiblemindcounseling.org. That's another way you can reach me, or at my Instagram handle @spellbound20.
Excellent. And I will link all that stuff for you guys in the show notes, so you can click on it easily to connect with Josh. So yay.
Awesome. Thank you so much for this conversation. Yes. It literally flew by.
I know.
I have to say, I was a little anxious coming in because it is a heavy topic.
It is. Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Yeah, it is.
Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. And, I'm going to repeat myself over and over again that dancers, if you're listening, this show is for you. This is your platform. So, having people like Josh on is so important to, again, validate, normalize, destigmatize, all of those things. It's all for you guys. So thank you, Josh, for sharing your expertise with us today, and hope to have you back on the show again.
Anytime.
All right. Thanks. Wow. What an empowering conversation today with Josh. I know that as a dance educator myself, it can be really, really difficult when you're faced with a situation where one of your students might potentially be struggling with some eating disorder issues. You never know what to say, and you don't want to say the wrong thing, and you certainly also don't want to be wrong and bring up an awkward subject if there isn't an issue. So I know how intimidating it can be as a leader in the dance world to approach these types of topics. And I know it can only be that much more difficult for parents as well to make sure they're watching out for their children and that they are having the healthiest experience they possibly can. So I'm so grateful. Big, huge shout out and thank you to Josh today for his time. He really did give us a lot of things to think about in the dance studio and at home. Some red flags, some examples of things you can say, what not to say. And I'm really grateful for all the work that he is doing in the dance world right now, particularly his specialized protocol in treating specifically dancers, not just athletes, but dancers with eating disorders, because they certainly have, you know, their own special needs. And I'm just really grateful for all the work that he's doing. I'm also grateful for you guys. Thank you to my listeners for listening today. I hope you enjoyed the episode. And if you did, please go ahead and leave me a 5-star rating and review on Apple Podcasts, follow the pod on Spotify, and share it with just 3 friends to get the word out. And of course, if you have any questions, particular topics you'd like me to cover, or guests you'd like to hear from, you can email those to me at dancebetterpodcast@gmail.com and also connect with me on Instagram at dancebetterpodcast. Thank you so much for listening today, you guys. I cannot wait to learn with you on the next episode. Bye.